What is Jay Powell thinking in exactly 1,305 words? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 26th day of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Jay Powell took a mercifully brief 8 minutes and 51 seconds to deliver the most anticipated economic speech of the year. Nothing against central bank speechifying, honestly, but shorter is almost always better. So we're going to take something less than 8 minutes to talk about it and the week in this economy. Lynette Lopez is at Business Insider. Sadeep Reddy is at Politico. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so Lynette, here's my take on this speech. You ready?
Ready.
I'm going to say it louder for people in the back. We're going to keep raising rates. How'd I do?
That was perfect. I don't know why Powell needed 1,300 words for it, except for the fact that probably since June, the market has been acting like with its fingers in its ear, la, la, la. It hadn't heard a single word that Jay Powell has been saying since this whole rate climbing, inflation busting debacle has begun, which is that it's not going to end until we've felt some pain and inflation has come under the heel or come to heel in the U.S. economy. And while we haven't seen much increase, according to Fed, measures,
right,
it's still bad.
Yeah. So number one, Sadeep, he did say pain a couple of times, as in there is going to be some. But also just on that market thing, I saw Kate Davidson on Twitter, our Friday colleague and yours at Politico, point out that it's like kids at the playground, right? No matter how many times you tell your kids we're leaving in 5 minutes, we're leaving in 2 minutes, we're leaving in 1 minute, they're always surprised. And somehow now the market today was surprised by Powell saying we're going to keep on raising rates. All y'all hold on.
He's like, I'm serious this time. And look, he's created a bit of a mess himself by sounding a little dovish at the press conference a month ago. He's trying to clean that up. But there was actually a very remarkable divide in markets today. The bond market barely moved. Yeah. The bond market actually had gotten the signal a while ago. It's the stock market that where all these traders had their fingers in the air, hoping that the worst had passed. And what Powell is actually trying to get at is it's not just about bringing inflation down from the peak. It's bringing it down closer to the target for the Fed, the 2%. And so a lot of stock investors have been thinking, oh, yeah, we're going to be coming down over some period and 7%, 6%, 5%, we're going to get there for inflation. But Powell knows that is not where you can end up. And he was trying to send a double message about not only we're going to keep raising rates, but we're not going to start turning around and lowering rates at the first sign of trouble either, which is actually something that markets have not digested very well.
Right. And Lynette, to be clear, this is going to take a while on the order of long, long numbers of months and years.
Possibly. We'll see how it goes. It depends on the situation in Europe. It depends on what's happening with China, with the zero COVID situation. It depends on a lot of things that are out of the Fed's control. So, it's hard. Powell always says we're going to stay data dependent. Mm-hmm. It's hard to say how long this is going to last. But what he can say is that it's not now. Wall Street should have known that. And maybe some of the activity that we're seeing in terms of the stock market leaping up is because there are so many people who have, over the last 2 months, gone on vacation, thrown in the towel. There's a low volume environment. We can't understate that. But it is surprising how surprised the stock market acted today.
It is surprising how surprised they were. Sudeep, I'm obliged to mention here that we did get an inflation reading this morning. Personal consumption expenditures came in at the core rate was 4.6% year on year. That's not a terrible number, right?
It's not a terrible number, but the Fed's target is 2%.
Yeah, well, yeah,
and right. And you got to get a lot more progress than that. And we've seen, look, so much of this has been driven by the supply chain effects and gasoline prices and the commodity effects. The big worry that's got to be on Jay Powell's mind is that you're seeing the shift more and more into services, and services inflation is inflation that sticks around a lot longer and is a lot more painful to clean up. And so that's what he's got to be worried about right now, is what if you get it at 4.5-5% inflation in wages coming month after month, year after year? That is not a situation you want to be in over a 4-year term as Fed chair.
Right. And yet, Lynette, this morning, consumer sentiment from the good people at the University of Michigan came in second up month in a row. Consumers still feel pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, when gas prices go down,
right.
It's a good feeling. You know, I think that that's the number that people see every day, like more consistently. And so I'm not surprised that consumer sentiment is turning around. Does it mean that everything has changed overall?
Right.
No, but
right. The
hard data and the soft data are not always the same anyway. So
that doesn't
surprise me much.
Sudeep, I'm going to try something with both of you that I did with Kate and Brian Chung last week. Do we think that the peak of inflation has come and gone in this economy, Sudeep?
It all depends on oil. It all depends on Russia. If we don't have another flare up, if we don't have further problems in the coming months with the Russian oil ban in Europe and elsewhere, then yeah, we've probably seen the peak of it. But that's a big if, and I don't really be betting on Russia at any point to make any economic projections.
Yeah, no, Lynette, what do you think? Same question.
I actually have the exact same answer, and yeah, no, I wouldn't rely on Putin or what he's doing or being able to see into the future there. I think that if we're lucky, yes. If we're lucky, yes, this is the peak.
All right. I will take that answer. Sudeep, really quickly, I want to point out gross domestic product. The second look at second quarter came in this week. It was negative 0.6% annualized, which is a little bit better than we had been thinking. The Atlanta Federal Reserve now says third quarter is going to come in at 1.6%. That's promising? Question mark.
Promising question mark that we're not going in this continuing slide.
Right.
Yes, but I don't think anybody really believed that this was the recession.
Yeah.
This was not the real thing. You've got to see the job market come apart. This was what Powell was preparing everyone for today in very, very clear terms. That is when the recession comes, and that is when you will see GDP actually decline for a couple quarters in a much more meaningful way. And so stay tuned on that front.
We shall. We shall indeed. Sudeep Reddy at Politico and Lynette Lopez at Business Insider. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, there was a whole lot of say it ain't so, Jay. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Workers at a Chipotle in Lansing, in Michigan, voted to unionize this week. That's the first location of that particular national fast food chain to do so, but just one of hundreds of individual restaurants and retail stores that have organized this year. Starbucks is up to 200 union shops across the country. A second REI store in Berkeley, California, as of yesterday. Two Trader Joe's, one Apple store. You get the idea. And it does feel like there's a whole ton of union activity, but it's also true that each of those union drives involves a relatively small number of workers, about a dozen at the Lansing Chipotle, about 100 at the Berkeley REI. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more now on why the labor movement is succeeding at small scale.
At the height of the U.S. labor movement in the 30s and 40s, unions accrued millions of members, organizing big industrial workplaces like factories and auto plants. But small-scale organizing has always been important, says historian Tobias Higbee at UCLA.
It doesn't take a central organization to coordinate the work of collecting cards, managing the election, etc.
So workers don't need the resources of a big or powerful union. It's also harder for employers to influence smaller groups, says Sharon Block, who heads the Labor and Work-Life Program at Harvard Law School.
Probably a big piece is the rapid response, right?
She says employers have more opportunities than unions to get their perspective out, requiring employees sit through information sessions or sending out all staff emails. But in smaller settings, organizers can make their case more effectively.
We talk to each other all the time and we share information and we helped each other when those conversations did happen.
Sarah Beth Ryther helped organize the staff of about 70 at the Minneapolis Trader Joe's, which unionized earlier this month.
We had already had 5 to 7 conversations with every single person on what to expect.
and got tips from a store in Massachusetts that unionized the previous month. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
You look up amateur in the dictionary, and it says a person who engages in a pursuit, especially a sport, on an unpaid rather than a professional basis. So with that in mind, I point out now that the absolutely not a professional, that's in air quotes, sport of college football starts a new season tomorrow. And I will also point out that earlier this week, Nick Saban signed a nearly $100 million deal to coach Alabama till he's in his late 70s. And I will further point out that last week, the Big Ten announced a 7-year TV deal worth at least $1 billion a year. And the athletes at the center of that industry are thinking now about revenue sharing now that they're allowed to make money off their names and images and likenesses. Marketplace's Andy Euler does sports for us.
When the NCAA said athletes could start making money off their names, images, and likenesses, some, like Patrick Risch at Washington University in St. Louis, said that was opening a Pandora's box.
It only seems to me a matter of time where you will find college athletics feel pressured to give these student athletes a cut of the media revenues.
Currently, athletes make money basically through endorsements. David Barry, an economics professor at Southern Utah University, says that keeps colleges and universities removed from any employment responsibilities. But he says that doesn't reflect reality.
The athletes are employees. They are hired. They are given a job. The job of an athlete takes precedence over anything else they're doing. If that's the rule, you're an employee. Your job is to play sports.
Barry thinks eventually colleges will have to put athletes on their payrolls. And Ellen Zavian at George Washington University says big schools like Alabama and Texas are preparing for how to make that work right now.
They're already having that conversation. And perhaps some of the larger sports like basketball and football will spin off into for-profit entities, remove themselves from the umbrella of the NCAA, and not have those regulations as a restraint.
Because, she says, the NCAA doesn't want to get involved with directly paying players. But if the NCAA wasn't around, that might make it easier for the multi-billion-dollar college football and basketball industries. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You know, you got to get Chris Pratt in the driver's seat or is things done?
I mean, I like Chris Pratt. I'm good with that. First, though, let's do the number. Oh, my goodness, the Wawa's. Dow Industrial's down 1,008 points. That's 3%, 32,283. Don't let 1,000 points scare you. NASDAQ down 497, nearly 4%, 12,141. S&P 500 tanked 141 points, 3.3%, 4,057. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow fell 4.2%, the NASDAQ down 4.4%, the S&P 500 subtracted 4%. Consumer spending ticked up a smidge in July, so let's check some places where consumers are, you know, spending that money. Discount retailer Dollar Tree, headquartered at the corner of Volvo Parkway and Pinnacle Drive in Chesapeake, Virginia, chopped off nearly 7%. Today, just off Remington Drive in Bolingbrook, Illinois, you'll find the HQ for Ulta Beauty. Cosmetics retailer reported better than expected results, but shares lost 1.8% anyway. From its perch at 2 Folsom Street, just off the Embarcadero in San Francisco, Gap reported an unexpected profit. Nonetheless, shares down 1.4%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Trying to control our carbon pollution is, of course, the best way to keep the planet from getting too hot. But the reality is that climate damage has already been done, so cities and towns around the country are trying to figure out how to deal with it. In some places, something called managed retreat is getting a hearing, voluntarily relocating homes or businesses or both away from the coast. Montauk, out at the tip of Long Island, is one of those places. Year-round, about 4,000 people live there. In the summertime, it's 25 or 30,000. It's a beach town, less than 3 miles across. And by 2070, best guesses are, it's probably just going to be a series of islands. So to adapt, a town committee is recommending, among other things, that parts of downtown Montauk that are right along the ocean be moved to higher ground. Marketplace's Samantha Fields took a drive out to Long Island.
Driving into downtown Montauk, you come up over a hill, and on a clear day,
there's nothing as far as the eye can see except the ocean.
Jennifer Folks grew up a few miles down the road, and now she's the director of the local Chamber of Commerce.
So this is downtown Montauk. John's Drive-In, Memory Motel, The Point.
You can park right downtown, walk just a couple of blocks, and be on the beach. Or if you're lucky and you can afford to spend hundreds, sometimes more than $1,000 a night, you can stay at one of the hotels right on the beach.
Some of them are just behind the sand dunes, and some of them are right on top of or where the sand dunes would have been.
Allison Branco is the Climate Adaptation Director for the Nature Conservancy in New York. She's been working with the town of East Hampton, which includes Montauk, on its Coastal Assessment and Resiliency Plan, figuring out how it can adapt to climate change. One of the recommendations is that the town move back from the shoreline in certain places voluntarily.
Does that mean where we're standing now on this beach with all these hotels and motels right on the sand, that these would all be gone?
It does mean that these hotels and motels would all be gone.
Not gone completely, just not right on the beach anymore. Branco says the idea is to relocate them to higher ground, give the beach space to move and change as it's supposed to, and better buffer the town from sea level rise. It is a pretty hard sell.
The allure of those hotels is being on the water.
Paul Monty is a longtime business owner in Montauk. His family owned one of the oceanfront resorts for decades.
So if we took those hotels and put them in the middle of a field somewhere, they will certainly not have the same draw as they do currently.
Monty does want the town to get more proactive about planning for climate change. He chairs the Beach Erosion Committee.
But, you know, the idea of just taking the entire oceanfront and moving it, you know, upstream to a high point just doesn't make sense to me.
It doesn't make sense to Leo Daunt either. He runs Daunt's Albatross, a hotel a block from the beach, that's been in his family for three generations.
Nobody in Montauk, none of these businesses are, you know, climate deniers. Everyone realized that there was a threat.
But right now, Daunt and Monty say there are just too many unanswered questions about managed retreat.
I have asked how this could make sense financially. Who has done it before? Where have they done it and how have they done it?
But no one has really done it before. Other cities and towns are also exploring it, but there isn't a community yet that Montauk can look to.
As much as it's nice to be the leader in something like this, when you're talking about people's livelihoods and the future of a community, you don't really want to be a guinea pig.
Instead, Monty would like to see the town focus more on other options, like replenishing the beaches. Allison Branco at the Nature Conservancy says the Army Corps of Engineers did come in after Superstorm Sandy a decade ago and put in geotube bags to shore up the dunes.
It's basically like a sandbag, only a giant version like the size of a bus, much like a seawall buried under the sand.
And the town has been spending about $1 million a year to put sand on the beach. But Branco says because of rising sea levels, that isn't a long-term solution.
There is no future where everything stays exactly like it is today.
More people are starting to see that. Jeremy Samuelson, the town planner, says when he talks to people about managed retreat now, they still bristle, but they're more open to talking about it than they were even 5 years ago.
I think one of the dangers here is we can underestimate the extent to which this is a very personal and very emotional journey that we're asking people to go on.
Many families in Montauk, like Paul Monty's, have been in town and passed their businesses down for generations.
What does this place mean to you? A lot of people, I think, hear the Hamptons, and they just think super wealthy, tourist destination, summer homes.
That's certainly a part of it. You know, a very important part. But no, no. Montauk is more than 3 months of the year. It's home.
And he says he wants to protect it. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
We all know algorithms play a huge role in the content that we watch, right? Think the trending section on Netflix or YouTube recommendations. But I saw a column on Bloomberg the other day about the role that artificial intelligence can play in what content gets made. Trung Phan had the byline. He is now a writer on business and technology for Bloomberg. Once upon a time, though, he tried screenwriting. Trung Phan, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. This is my first radio appearance, I believe. Maybe I've done another one. I don't know.
well, good. World premiere or whatever. Speaking of world premieres, tell me about this screenplay you wrote called The Lose.
Okay, so I write now publicly on the internet quite a bit, including a column with Bloomberg. But 10 years ago, I was living in Ho Chi Minh City, and I had dreams of being a screenwriter. And I managed to put a comedy script together and sold it to Fox. Now, the logline for that film was The Fugitive meets Harold and Kumar, set in Southeast Asia.
Okay.
It was just ahead of its time. They weren't ready to make it, okay? but TLDR, it didn't get made. And now we're about a decade later.
All right. So how did it come to pass that you wound up writing a column about it?
So I wrote about the story of writing and selling the script ages ago. And the CEO of an artificial intelligence company, the company's called Cordo AI, happened to read my newsletter. And he's like, "Hey, Trung, I read this article that you wrote about this old script of yours. It just so happens that my company has technology that uses artificial intelligence to kind of scan screenplays. And the way they describe it is they look for the narrative DNA of a screenplay. And they can basically tell you why a film could or cannot succeed. I already knew that my film couldn't, but I wanted to find out."
Being a glutton for punishment, you decided to actually get the analytics. So they run your script through the algorithm. Well, how do they know? What are they looking for?
So the CEO of Vest told me that they have a database of about 700,000 scripts. I guess in the AI industry and machine learning, a lot of what you do is you kind of tag certain items. So as an example, in script writing, you can usually tell when a screenplay transitions from the first to the second to the third act. So basically they have this giant catalog and they wanted to run my script against their giant catalog.
So they come back with some report and they tell you what?
So the report comes back. I'm not going to bury the lead here. They said your film is not very commercially viable. So they come back with something I already knew. Having said that, though, they correctly identified actually the genre of the film I was going after. One of the top comparisons that they pulled up was The Hangover 2, which was set in Bangkok.
Yeah.
But they said two things specifically about my script that made it not super marketable. So they have these two scores that they calculate. One is called interestingness, and another is called uniqueness. So what interestingness does is it looks at the range of characters in a script. So obviously most films will have the protagonist and the villain, but then other films, really good films, will have a lot of good secondary and tertiary characters. Apparently my script didn't have those. Whereas if you take a movie like The Godfather, you probably have half a dozen or 10 characters that you actually see how they progress. But to my credit, that's a 3-hour movie and I'm not Francis Ford Coppola.
Yeah, exactly. And it's worth pointing out here, actually, and this is my favorite part of it, that they also recommended if this film did get made, if the studio put Chris Pratt in it, it might work.
Yeah.
Right.
They basically chose Chris Pratt as the silver bullet for his script.
Right.
They're just like, we looked through the entire 700,000 film and TV database, and based on the interestingness that I just touched on and the lack of uniqueness to it, which is the other score, they're like, it's too similar, the pacing of it and kind of the structure.
Yeah.
That your only chance now is, you got to get Chris Pratt in the driver's seat or
well,
it's things
look,
done.
If Chris Pratt is a Marketplace listener, maybe we can hook you up. But wait a minute. You mentioned The Godfather, right? And so here's where I want to go bigger picture on Hollywood and AI. The Godfather almost didn't get made like 10 different times, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so now we're trying to put AI into this unbelievably subjective what makes a good movie. And I wonder what you think of that. Set aside your own bad experiences with your film, but come on, man, how do they know?
I'm 100% on the same page with you on this. So one thing I will say is that the AI is advancing just so incredibly fast that I'm hedging a little bit and be like, yeah, will I be completely out of a job as a writer in 10 years? Maybe.
Right.
So there's that.
Yeah. Trung Phan, he writes on business and technology from Bloomberg Opinion. He's got a Substack. He's got a podcast. You should follow him on Twitter because that's just super entertaining as well. He might not be a screenwriter, but, whatever. There's hope. Trung, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. That was fantastic.
This final note on the way out today. Jon Snow knows nothing. Winter is coming, and so too is a second season of House of the Dragon, the Game of Thrones spinoff. HBO made the announcement today, along with noting that, oh, by the way, 20 million people watched the first episode last week, including me. Honestly, though, I thought it was like 8.5 out of 10. Holy cow, look at the time we gotta go. No moment of economic context today. My apologies. You'll have to find one for yourself, I suppose. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Neil Scarborough's vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.